It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears, Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison barbershop is also home to a men's health center. We'll hear how a new grant will help the center expand its mission to improve the health of African-American men in Dane County.
Now, traditional history often documents the lives and experiences of the powerful and privileged of a particular time.
That means it can be hard to go back and reconstruct the lives of the rest of us in the usual ways. If they're an option, one of the best ways is to use oral histories of people of the time or from their descendants.
Lifelong Madison resident and longtime educator Muriel Sims did just that to research her book titled Settlin', Stories of Madison's Early African-American Families. Muriel, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You spoke with descendants of some of Madison's first African-American families. What brought those first Black settlers to Madison, and when did they start coming?
I start the search beginning 1846. So we do know that early African-American folks came here as early as 1846. I interviewed the descendants of people who came here in the early 1900s. So that is really basically when the majority of people started coming to Madison and settling here.
And what brought them here?
Well, one of the reasons that I could figure out is that they had relatives already here or by word of mouth. I know that in my dad's case, he came up here in 1927, but John Parrish knew him in Missouri, found out he was here, and followed him up here. Others happened to hear about Madison and came here. Others were traveling through Madison, liked it, and stayed.
And so you mentioned Missouri. Where else were some of those early families coming from?
One family, the Hopkins family, came from Houston, Texas, I believe. Another, several from Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, or Georgia. So we sort of followed the Mississippi River in some cases and other cases not.
Interesting. So how did you track down descendants of those early families?
I knew many of the descendants, and I asked them if they would be willing to be interviewed. And most of them said yes.
And I'm guessing that when you talked to them, they also said, oh, and make sure you talk to so-and-so.
They did. They did. And I knew their parents. So, I mean, I remember Mrs. Stamps of years ago and Mrs. Grimes and all of the people who were their relatives, I knew already. So when they referred to them and how they lived, I was very familiar with that context.
So there are stories in your book that relate to the experience of living in different parts of Madison, but the neighborhood that's mentioned over and over is the Greenbush neighborhood or the Bush. Tell us about that neighborhood in the early 20th century when many of those Black families were making it their home.
I don't know that much about the neighborhood itself. I remember living over across the railroad tracks from the Greenbush. I could not go over there. I was too young, so I couldn't cross the tracks to go to the Greenbush. But I remember that it was a very cozy neighborhood. That's what I remember. And that people seemed to get along very well over there. That is the fundamental truth of that neighborhood, is regardless of the ethnicity, folks there got along and they helped each other. There seemed to be very little, if any, conflict whatsoever.
Well, and that's interesting because it was African American. It was also very Italian and very Jewish.
Yes.
And so one could imagine that there might have been conflict. But in the stories, it really does seem, I mean, obviously, like any neighborhood, not everyone's going to get along. But it did seem like there was something that pulled those families together.
Well, my perception is that they were in the same similar income level. They were all struggling. Many of them had two jobs. They seemed to be kind of in the same boat, so to speak. So there really was no reason to get excited about race or income or gender issue, any of those issues that we commonly find ourselves in today. There was no reason. They were too busy trying to make a way out of no way. And also, they wanted to start their own businesses. They were entrepreneurs. And people forget about that part of their lives. So you had these, you know, the conflict of the new ethnic groups with Caucasians trying to get in their way. But you also had them very family-oriented and trying to make a living.
We're talking with Muriel Sims. Her new book is Settlin', Stories of Madison's Early African-American Families. And Muriel, what were some of the institutions that were hubs for the African-American community in Madison in those early days? What brought people together?
Well, the church was the main one. I would say that just the socializing activities that they came up with helped pull them together. Church was on Sundays and maybe another time during the week, but they also went to Brittingham Park for picnics or for outdoor gatherings. They had clubs. They had at least 7 or 8 clubs. Most of them were women's clubs, and a couple of them were men's clubs, like the Lodge, for example. So they had their way of creating their own institutions in order to socialize and find mentorships and friendships.
And it also sounded like some of those groups, the clubs, were also meant to help new arrivals get settled in Madison.
They were an avenue by which newcomers could get settled. They came to know people who could help them find lodging, help them find a safe place to be. So yes, those institutions were helpful in that regard.
So Muriel, challenges in housing, employment, and education seem to have been common problems to face for those early Madison families. How did they deal with those issues? One of the things I found really interesting was how they tended to deal with the fact that whites didn't want to rent to them, so they had to find other housing options.
Yes, they did. Many of the families housed newcomers. That was the essential piece of how newcomers stayed here and why they wanted to stay here. My family had a small house, but we rented rooms to students who wanted to go to the university. Our house was the closest place to the university campus. So we were a desirable place for folks to stay. But there were many other homes in the 600 block of Dayton Street, as well as the Allison House, the most famous house on Mound Street, that housed African Americans who came here, not just individuals, but families.
So if long-term residents were able to buy their own home, then they could turn around and provide housing for others.
Exactly. That's how it happened.
And you mentioned entrepreneurs, and that really struck me in reading these oral histories, too, is that because there were a lot of doors that were closed to African-Americans for employment, they often started their own enterprises.
They did. Many of them were barbers. One of the misconceptions about barbership is that some people seem to think, some newcomers, some black newcomers, I will say, seem to think that barbering started in 1950. Well, barbering goes back to prior to 1900, and we had barbershops from 1900 to 1950. So one of the purposes of the book is to clear up some of these misperceptions that are going around. Yeah, I felt that was a motivator for me to get this book completed before people continue to have these misperceptions.
Well, and Muriel, your family has been in Madison for a very long time, as you were saying, just like those with whom you did interviews. What did this project mean for you personally?
It was a bucket list. As I said before, I began to hear not so good things said. Misperceptions, misconceptions, mischaracterizations of early African Americans, that bothered me. So I felt like I had to work a lot harder to get this book done and get it out in the public's eye so that the public could understand that we really had a thriving community and that we were who we were. One of the misperceptions or mischaracterizations, I should say, was that A black college professor had said something about one of our earlier African-American families being a butler at the Capitol. He was not a butler. He may have described himself as a butler, but we as a community never thought of him as a butler. He was a man who had a job at a place. And that's how we thought about ourselves. We weren't maids, we weren't butlers, we were no kind of label of any kind. So when I hear things like that, I get a little wrinkly. And I don't mind saying to people that I don't like that, mm-hmm. because that is not fair to the community that existed back then.
Well, Muriel, thank you so much for sharing the stories and your time with us.
Thank you again.
Muriel Sims is a lifelong Madison resident and longtime educator in the Madison Metropolitan School District. She serves as an adjunct faculty member in the doctoral program in educational leadership at Edgewood College. She joined us to talk about her book, Settlin', Stories of Madison's Early African-American Families.
Coming up, we'll hear how a Madison barbershop is helping African-American men get information about their health and find treatment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, wit can be hard to define, but we know it when we hear it. We'll find out more with the author of the new book, Wit's End.
First, customers at JP's Hair Design in Madison can come away with more than just a haircut. The shop is also home to the Men's Health and Education Center, a place for blood pressure screenings, BMI calculations, and advice on where to seek treatment for a variety of health problems.
It's part of an effort by the Rebalanced Life Wellness Association to reduce disparities in health issues between African-American men and white men in Dane County. Thanks to a $300,000 grant, the project is planning to expand to other barbershops in the area. Aaron Perry is the founder of Rebalanced Life Wellness Association. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much.
Also with us is Jeff Patterson, known as JP, owner of JP's Hair Design. Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us.
No problem. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Aaron, why put health centers in barbershops?
Yeah, well, you know, the focus really right now is on JP Hair Design. And so I know that there's some media that we're going to try to put one in every barbershop. That's not the direction that we're going right now. We will like to do screenings, oral screenings, blood pressure screenings in other barbershops. But the plan right now is not to put a whole men's health center
gotcha.
In another barbershop. But, you know, the barbershop has always played a significant social and cultural role in the, you know, in the black community. And when you hear the medical community say that they cannot engage black men, we knew. JP obviously has known for 20 years. And as a client of the barbershop, I realized this is where the men are at. So if you want to reach them, you have to go where they're at, and that's the barbershop.
And JP, did you think this was a natural fit when you first heard about this idea?
Yeah, Aaron was very strategic when he sat me down and talked to me about his vision. Of course, in the barbershop, you hear tons and tons of ideas, you know. And Aaron's pitch to me on the Men's Health Education Center, it was so clear. It was something that, you know, resonated in me, and it was a green light. It was something that, you know, I wanted to do. It made sense. I didn't even have space for it in the shop, but it came to fruition. It was meant to happen. We got space, and we were able to make it work.
Aaron, can you talk about some of the health challenges that African-American men are facing in Dane County, but elsewhere, too?
Yeah, primarily when you look at heart disease, you look at, obviously, blood pressure. For instance, a good example is just last month we did 84 blood pressure screenings. And of that 84, 68% of men had high blood pressure.
Wow.
And that told us a number of things is that, you know, obviously some of the men did not have health care coverage. So we're working with them now to get BadgerCare to get them enrolled. And then the other gentlemen that did have good insurance, but haven't been to their primary care physicians, we're really working on that. But heart disease, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, we're hearing a lot of men, you know, that are diagnosed at an alarming rate with diabetes. So those are the areas that we're really focused on. Also, the tooth pain, we are doing oral screenings because we know that one of the areas that, you know, men tend to go to the ER is because of mouth pain. Hmm. And so we're really focused on our oral screenings as well.
JP, a customer comes in to your for a haircut. What happens then? How do they get connected with the health side of this?
Well, the men's health center, it's placed in a great spot in the shop. Everybody that come in can see it. Another great thing is our clients trust us as barbers. They trust what we say. You know, we can persuade them. So it's easy to talk to our clients about just go in, get a blood pressure check. If we hear that they're having some type of issue and we have the student nurses in or errands in, we can have them go in and talk, you know, with one of the students about their issue. It changed how we talk in the shop. We talk more health now. We talk about health, you know, and how we doing. And we got it right here. We can educate people and let them know how to deal with different ailments they may have.
Aaron, JP mentioned the student nurses. Can you talk about the, you know, who's providing healthcare? Where are the staff coming from?
Yeah, so right now we have the Edgewood College nursing students. We have interns that come in, and they do, I believe it's about a 16 or 18-week internship with us. And they assist with screenings, data entry. We go into the community. We did a really nice blood pressure screening over at La Follette with many of the Black Student Union members. And, you know, these are some of the things that we do, not just inside of the Men's Health Center, but we try to go mobile into the community as well.
And Aaron, you mentioned, you know, people come in, they find out they have high blood pressure. But what's next? You mentioned access. A lot of people don't have healthcare access, or they don't know what's out there for
right
them.
Yeah, and that's really kind of where we're at. I mean, we're really when we think about the barbershops, I believe this is the model. I believe it's the new healthcare model, and time is up for everyone that's been out here attempting to make a difference, but have, you know, I don't want to say failed, but maybe haven't been creative enough. And that is really what we are trying to do, get the health care in the hands of the men that need it the most.
Talking to Aaron Perry, founder of Rebalanced Life Wellness Association, and Jeff Patterson, also known as JP, owner of JP's Hair Design, about this project, bringing healthcare into the barbershop, trying to address health disparities for African-American men. JP, you mentioned this is changing the conversation. So what are people talking about now when they talk about their health and well-being?
Well, a lot of times the blood pressure come up, because that's something that can be done real quick. It's not an invasive, you know, they go right into the Men's Health Education Center and get checked. They know their reading, they know where they're at, you know, if their blood pressure is high or if it's good or low. So that, you hear a lot about the blood pressure check. We've had people come in, Aaron talked about it earlier, about having tooth pain and mouth pain. With the oral screenings, you know, we've been able to direct them to a dentist. And another thing that people talk about is weight loss now. Yes. You know, staying healthy, eating right, and working out. So I think the conversation's changed. We've had some challenges among the barbers as far as losing weight and going to work out. So it's a good thing. It's moving towards the right direction.
Aaron, is that part of the, I guess, counseling or advice people are getting, not just maybe blood pressure medication, but information about exercise, nutrition options?
Absolutely. You know, whatever it takes for us to move that needle in the health disparities. One of the things that we did with the Edgewood College nursing students is we actually did taught all of the barbers how to do blood pressure screenings. We purchased the wrist blood pressure cuff. So basically, while the barbers are cutting hair, we can actually do a screening right at the same time. And so these are kind of the things that we're getting really creative about, and it's really making a difference for the men that don't have a lot of time.
JP, when you went into being a barber, did you ever think you'd be learning to do blood pressure screenings along the way?
No, I've been amazed on how much exposure we've gotten and how we've helped people, you know, with this health education initiative that Aaron partnered up with us at the shop with. It's been awesome.
Do you ever get, you know, pushback, JP, people like, hey, I'm just here for a haircut, I don't want to talk about my health?
Yeah, of course, that happens. And the thing is, it happens, and next thing you know, maybe visit number 5 or visit number 6, they end up in the Men's Health Education Center. So sometimes, you know, take, you know, a couple of times to ask or for them to see and know that this is, you know, something that can help them. So, no, they don't buy in all the time at the first pitch. But eventually, you know, they pop in and say hi to Aaron or get their blood pressure checked. So they know if they need something, they can come right to the barbershop where they trust, you know, the people here and get education on health and get blood pressure checked. So it's here for them. You know, they may not go in today, but they may go in tomorrow.
We'll get them.
And Aaron, what are some of your next steps now that you've had some success here?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is creating a barbershop health advisory committee, and that is getting all of the 8 barbershop owners together, and we'll be meeting once a month. It's getting everyone together so we can have one mission and one voice throughout the county, so that when we talk about different health challenges, it can be a consistent message throughout all of the barbershops.
JP, do you think that your customers are keeping this with them when they leave your barbershop? They're going out and talking about it maybe with friends and family.
Yeah, I know it's life-changing for some of the guys. They talk about it, and the thing is, you know, a lot of the guys come in every 2 weeks. Some come in once a week. Some come in every 3 weeks. So it's constantly, they're constantly seeing it. They're constantly, you know, getting reminded about, you know, staying educated on their health. So, I mean, it's in front of them at all times. And once again, they trust what we say as barbers. So long as we preaching the right message, you know, it'll resonate with our clients.
Aaron, are you getting people coming to you and wanting to steal your idea in a good way, saying, hey, maybe there's other, maybe for different groups of people, maybe it's not the barbershop, it's something else, but we like this model?
Yeah, well, me and JP got pretty much, we're getting that wrapped up because, you know, we anticipate that. But the reality is that we were the first out the gate with this concept, and we're really looking forward to, you know, bringing this nationwide. We believe we have the model here.
JP and Aaron, thanks for joining us. Jeff Patterson, known as JP, is the owner of JP's Hair Design. Aaron Perry is the founder of the Rebalanced Life Wellness Association and started the Men's Health and Education Center in the barbershop. A new grant will help him expand that idea to other shops in the area.
Coming up after the news, who is the wittiest person you know? Maybe it's you. We'll find out why wit is such an important part of being human. I'm Judith Sears, Plus One.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears, Poisson. Coming up, Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum recently talked with Appleton singer-songwriter Adriel Denae about her new album, musical upbringing, and inspiration behind her music.
First, when you hear a pun, do you love it or groan out loud? Wit and wordplay have been part of how humans express themselves for as long as we've been humans.
Or, as the cast of Monty Python once put it,
there is only one thing in the world worse than being witty, and that is not being witty.
James Geary is deputy curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and the author of several books on words and language. His newest book is Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, before I looked inside your book, I thought, oh, it's going to be tough to write, you know, essays and all this dry history of wit and so on and still have fun with it. That's not what you did. You went for kind of a show, don't tell approach. Talk about how you tackled, in a lot of different ways, wit.
Right. Well, I tried the dry explanatory approach first. And reading my early drafts of the book, I realized trying to explain wit was destroying it in the process. And I was really kind of panicking because I thought, how am I ever going to write a book about wit without destroying the joke? And my son is an actor, and he went to drama school, and I was talking to him one day on the phone, and he said he was watching Buster Keaton films for one of his classes. Buster Keaton, the famous silent comic, who's one of my all-time favorite wits and heroes. And our kids grew up watching Buster Keaton films. And I said, well, why don't you tell your teacher that I'm writing a book about wit, and I'd be happy to come and talk about Buster Keaton and wit and how it applies to acting. And to my shock and surprise, his teacher said yes. And while I was talking to the acting students about wit, that's when I had the idea, I need to make this book witty and not just about wit, but make it witty itself. And that's how I ended up writing each chapter in a style that matches a different kind of wit. So, for example, the chapter that's about verbal wit is written as a dramatic dialogue from a play, and that comes directly from that experience at my son's acting class. But there's also a chapter written in rap. There's a chapter about the neuroscience of wit, how wit might work in the brain, that's written like a scientific paper. there's a chapter about spiritual wit that's written as a sermon. There's a chapter on about the philosophy of jokes that's written in the voice of a guy at a bar telling jokes. And there's other chapters written in heroic couplets of Alexander Pope and all kinds of other different styles. And again, the style of each chapter is intended to match the kind of wit that I'm discussing in that chapter. So you're absolutely right. I tried to show what wit is rather than tell about it.
But one thing that emerges in all these different styles is, I think if you asked me earlier, I might think, oh, wit, it's kind of a luxury of human language. It's an extra, it's kind of fun stuff. And the more different ways you look at it, no, it's kind of central to how we think and communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the key insights that I had as a result of writing the book is I think we tend to think of witty people as stand-up comedians and like people like Robin Williams with a really special kind of gift for speaking and using verbal wit. But actually, wit is a kind of fundamental aspect of human intelligence and creativity. And we tend to think of wit as making jokes, but wit is really even deeper than that. It's about making connections. And you can make connections if you're an inventor, for example, or if you're a business innovator, an entrepreneur, a scientist, a visual artist, or someone like Buster Keaton, who never said a word on screen and is incredibly witty. And I think what I discovered as a result of writing the book is that wit is really a kind of intelligence, and it has to do with like perceiving and gathering information from lots of different sources and being able to synthesize those different information points into something new, into something fresh, into something innovative. So the kind of laugh you get from a punchline is the same kind of shock of recognition, surprise, delight that an inventor has when she makes a discovery, or a scientist has when she makes a discovery. So you have the ha-ha of the punchline, but you have the aha of discovery, and you also have the ah of like aesthetic experience, artistic experience. And I think those reactions are all prompted by different kinds of wit, which, like I said, is a kind of the operating system of human creativity.
I do admire the people who are really good at being quick-witted. Sometimes I think I'm really witty after the fact. I think I'm one of those people who, you know, the next day I have, or sometimes 3 years later, think of the hilarious thing to say. Can we cultivate that, I guess, quick-wittedness?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's a term for the affliction that you suffer, Rob. It's called l'esprit d'escalier. It's a French phrase from the French philosopher Denis Diderot. And what it means is the wit of the staircase. And it actually comes from an experience that he had. He was at a dinner party, and he was insulted by a guest. And he was so taken aback and flustered that he couldn't think of a proper response. And he only thought of a proper response when he was walking down the stairs on his way out and on his way home. And that's why he called it the wit of the staircase. And I think one way to kind of train your mind to be witty, and this may, I know, upset some listeners who think puns are the lowest form of wit, but making puns is a great way to keep your mind agile and limbered up. And again, making a pun is identifying two separate things, you know, a pun, two different words that sound alike, but they have separate meanings. And when you bring them together in a pun, you create that that reaction of surprise and delight. And that's basically the essence of true wit, the ability to hold in the mind two different ideas about the same thing at the same time. So when George Carlin, for example, said atheism is a non-profit institution, he was making a really funny pun about non-profit in the sense of religious seers and non-profit in the sense of not accepting any financial reward. So that's a kind of a very clever pun, but it's also a philosophical statement, a sort of critique about religions, which many of which claim to be non-profit, but are among the wealthiest institutions on earth. So I think a pun kind of re-energizes the mind precisely by making these surprising connections. And the more you do it, the easier it gets, and the more fun it gets.
James Geary is with us. His new book is called Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. Well, funny you should mention puns, James. We did a show about puns about a year ago, and we recruited a couple of our WPR classical music hosts, Norman Gilliland and Stephanie Elkins, to record some. Here's a little listen.
What do you call a snobbish criminal walking down the stairs? A condescending condescending.
To the mathematician who invented zero, thanks for nothing.
I've accidentally swallowed some Scrabble tiles. My next trip to the bathroom could spell disaster. Oh my God.
Now, there's an extra level here, James, of our fairly dignified on-air personalities sharing these bad jokes and puns with us. That kind of adds to the fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you know what's those are amazingly good puns, by the way. I think the what's interesting about a pun is that it not only makes you laugh, but it makes you think. And I think that's another characteristic of true wit. It's not just about the laugh, but it leaves a trail of thought after it. And I think what you also see in puns, and this is true of jokes and witty remarks in general, is that the person who makes the pun, you know, thinks of that connection between Scrabble and a trip to the bathroom spelling disaster, for example. But the person who hears the pun has to make the identical connection. So the person who originates the pun and the person who understands the pun are actually performing the same intellectual creative work. They are figuring out the same connections. One is doing it in one direction and the listener is doing it in the other direction. But I think that's part of the joy of puns and wit in general, is that they challenge you. They challenge you to figure something out. They don't present you with everything kind of laid out and explained, but you have to do just as much creative work as the person who originates the pun or the joke. And I think that's why even listening to puns also kind of trains your mind to be more witty.
That's the joy of puns. I am someone who does tell a lot of puns, and yeah, sometimes people laugh, but sometimes friends, family, and coworkers, I'll get that sense, oh, this guy again. Why do we sometimes hate puns and those who share them?
I don't know. I think anything, if it's, I think we've all had the experience of someone who thinks he's witty and is perhaps not as witty as he thinks he is.
Yeah, that's me.
Or someone who relentlessly delivers puns and jokes and wisecracks and things like that. And so I think that's, I think that may be part of it, because puns, like everything else, I think are best in moderation. But I also think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about humor. And I think people tend to assume that if you're being funny, if you're being witty, you're not being serious. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think witty people, even when they're being funny, are some of the most serious people around. In fact, to stick with the French, the French word for wit is spirituel. It means witty, but it also means spiritual, as in religion. And I think that's a great example of how wit combines the most lighthearted and the most serious aspects of human life. And to be able to have both of those things in your mind, you know, when you're in a a situation, a crisis situation or an emergency, or you have to solve a problem, and you can make a witty, lighthearted remark, it shows that you're really engaging with the problem and you're thinking very broadly. And again, you're kind of processing lots of different information. And as you said at the top of the conversation, making a joke like that releases tension. It kind of gives people energy, intellectual and physical energy, and makes them feel, you know, up and is motivating. And I think that's why, you know, well-deployed wit and well-deployed puns can be really inspiring.
James Geary is with us talking about wit and why we appreciate witty people and comments so much. His latest book is called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It.
And we want to hear from you. Do you enjoy puns and plays on words? Do you make them yourself? Who's the wittiest person you know, and what makes their humor successful? If you think you're witty, tell us why. Tweet us at Central Time, WPR.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about wordplay and wit with James Geary. He's the author of the new book called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a punster? Do you regularly make people groan with your wordplay? Or do you wish you could think of a good witticism in the moment, but end up with a great comeback hours later? Tweet us at Central Time WPR now, or anytime you have something witty to say.
James, you wrote about, and in some ways wrote as, a number of different historical witty figures. Through this whole process, who, now that you've done this, who do you really respect and think, wow, they are really the pinnacle of wit in some ways?
Wow. Well, it's really hard to choose just one, but
you can pick more than one. Sure.
Well, I mentioned Buster Keaton. I just love Buster Keaton, and what I admire so much about him is he manages to be witty without ever saying a word, and the way that he plays with the laws of physics. And he's not using CGI. I mean, he made his films in the 19-teens and 20s, most of them. And the simplicity but ingeniousness of his wit, I think, is just incredible. And it never ceases to amaze me. Just a couple quick examples. He's in one of his short films, he's on a boat and his girlfriend falls overboard and he's rushing around trying to save her as she's drowning, and he gets a life preserver from the side of the ship and he throws it into the water, and immediately the life preserver sinks. He comes home from work, he opens the door, goes into his apartment, takes out a piece of chalk from the pocket of his coat, he draws a hook on the wall, then takes off his coat and hangs his coat on the hook that he just drew. It's just these beautiful ways that he plays with how we see things and what we see. So I would say Buster Keaton is one of my all-time wittiest people.
Let's go to our callers now. Ethan is with us in Janesville. Ethan, I understand you have a pun or two for us.
Hi, nice to speak to you. Yeah, I work at the DNR here, and our forester is just loaded with puns. Seems to make quite a game out of it. He leaves me stumped. More than to admit.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, as you can tell, it can go pretty far, pretty fast.
Does he branch out into other areas of punning?
No, he mainly keeps it to trees, nuts, stumps, all things tree and forest.
All right. Well, quite a few oaks there to share, I'm sure, Ethan. Thank you so much for that.
Ooh, very good,
and
Rob.
I imagine a lot of, there are a lot of like specialty groups or insider groups that really go deep with their puns. James.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think people with a certain kind of specific knowledge, they can make puns that only someone else with that same set of information can understand. And that's why sometimes you see jokes from one culture don't really translate to another culture. And that's because to get a joke, you have to understand the context and the associations. And if you don't have the same set of associations, it can be hard to get the wit.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that. There can be a dark side of wit, James. I mean, I think of people talk about Dorothy Parker and her circle, and a lot of them are like mean jibes, hilarious, but mean. Or I played that clip of Monty Python doing Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw trying to one-up each other with wit. Can it take kind of a mean turn?
Yeah, I think wit can be used as a weapon. And in fact, the way that we talk about people who are witty, they have like a rapier wit, or they make a cutting remark. Those are all kind of metaphors that have to do with fencing. And wit can be a kind of, we also talk about the battle of wits. It can be like a fencing match with, people sparring and trying to get the sharpest stab at the most sensitive spot. And so I think, yeah, the way that wit can be deployed is as a kind of defensive mechanism. So you can be witty to distract from other types of feelings you may be experiencing. But yes, wit can be used as a weapon, and it can be used as a way to kind of humiliate or demean other people.
Talking to James Geary, author of Wits End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. That book comes out tomorrow. James, you did one of your chapters is, as you said, a scientific essay on the neuroscience of wit. What happens in our brains when we hear that, say, that pun that makes us stop and think?
Well, there are one theory is that there are two basic operating modes of the brain, the default network and the executive network. And the executive network kicks into gear when we're focused on a specific task, like we're trying to solve a problem, or we're trying to fix a car engine, or we're trying to do some mathematical equation. The default network is sort of the background operating mode of the human mind. And that's sort of like daydreaming, or when you're just kind of letting your mind wander, or sort of like the psychological equivalent of looking out the window of a train, and you're aware of all the things passing by. You're very aware of everything around you, but your attention is very diffuse, and it's not specified towards a specific task. And I think in that state, the default network of the brain, that's when we hear the various associations. So the guy who's making all the puns about trees and branches, and your great pun about oak, we hear all this, and because our attention is spread very, very wide, we pick up, oh yeah, that's also a reference to trees, and that's a reference to trees, and we wouldn't be able to pick up those different references if we were overly focused on one task. So when you're being witty, whether you're making a witty remark or hearing one, your attention is ranging very, very far in the mode of the default network.
Time for one more caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. And Jeff, I think you have a joke to share.
Yeah, isn't it ironic when a veterinarian has to go see a doctor because he has a hoarse voice?
Jeff, thanks. And there's so much. Is the English language particularly set up for puns, James, or does everybody get to share in this kind of fun? Because there's so many words. Homophones, is that what it is? The words that spell different sound the same? We have a lot of fun available to us briefly.
Yeah, we do. I mean, English is made up of, it's influenced by so many other languages. So we have more to choose from, but every language has those same kind of punning ability. And in fact, there's even a term for making a pun that's also puns on a word in another language, and it's called macaronic, where macaroni comes from. So you could say something like jokes about German sausage are the worst. And that's a macaronic pun because the worst in English and vorst in German sound the same.
And the French president could tell macaronic puns as well.
You are good, Rob. You are good.
I try. I really psyched myself up for this one. James, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
James Geary is deputy curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and the author of several books on words and language. His newest book is called Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It.
There's a Christmas season joke that there's really only one fruitcake in the world and it just keeps getting regifted.
Well, that's not quite true. It turns out that it actually could be, given fruitcake's freakishly long shelf life.
We swear we are not making this up. In Ohio, one family has kept the same fruitcake since it was baked in 1878. They have taken occasional nibbles for scientific purposes, I guess, and have lived to tell the tale.
And in Antarctica, a fruitcake left by explorer Robert Falcon Scott's 1910 expedition was discovered among other artifacts from that group. The researchers who found it said it was, quote, almost edible, which means at least one person thought tasting a fruitcake more than a century old was a good idea.
So what gives fruitcake its longevity? It turns out it's a couple things. First, a lot of the ingredients in it, like nuts and dried fruits, have a very low moisture content, so it's not very hospitable to microbes that might feast on a less dense baked good.
And there's the booze. Many fruitcake recipes call for soaking in alcohol as a key part of the process. That makes it maybe taste better, I guess, but not prone to mold.
In fact, Wisconsin's Swiss Colony, which has been making fruitcakes since the 1960s, says that letting a fruitcake age actually improves the taste. You know, a little like wine, fruitcakes get better with time.
So make a time capsule, pop this year's fruitcake in it, and let the people of the future give it a taste.
There you go. And it'll be just as good as it is today.
Yum. This is Central Time.